Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
This is Fran Lewis, and I'm your host, and I'm waiting for the author of Careful What You Wish For to come on, but while I'm waiting, I'm going to tell you about, oh, here she is, thank God. Okay. Hallie?
Hi, I'm here.
Oh, I got worried because my intro started and I said,
sorry.
Oh, my God. That's okay, I'm glad you're here. This book is really fantastic, and I've got about 20 people that want it after I'm done with the show, seriously.
Oh, that's good. I'm happy to hear that.
Well, they're not getting it. They're going to have to go on Amazon and get it themselves. So,
amen to that.
this is great because Gina sent it, and I had no idea that I was getting this book. And I said, oh, my God, this is fantastic. So the character in the book, Emily, I would love her to straighten out my closet. Seriously? This is... Because it's a mess, and there's no hope for me. So what made you decide to choose something like that? And decluttering business, I'm telling you, there should be more people like that in the world. It's just fantastic.
Well, actually, I've been thinking about writing this book since way early in my writing career, when I first started writing personal essays, which is how most of us start, you know, complaining about our families and our husbands.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, I was complaining about my husband, who cannot pass a yard sale without stopping. And so the whole idea of decluttering is a dream for me. I mean, he keeps his stuff out of the attic and the basement. But a lot of the first pieces I wrote were my frustration, working out my frustration with having a man who just is, it's a mixed marriage, you know. He wants to acquire stuff, and I like to get rid of it and have things nice and tidy. So it just seemed like an idea that I'd been noodling around with so long. So why not make the main character and her husband at odds? This conflict
mm-hmm.
is such a precious thing in a novel over her career and his habits.
Well, I think this is so cool because I'm pretty neat, and I have everything in the closet. But my husband has a habit of putting his stuff on the floor, inside. He says, I don't have enough
yes.
room, so he takes. They don't take the stuff off the top of the dresser. That's mine. They'll put it on the floor too. He's afraid that the dress is going to tip over. The sweatshirts. They're
yeah.
not going to do anything. So, how does she decide to do this? This is like, how did Emily do this? And you had to do research into this, didn't you? You had to do some research to figure out how to do this, because this is brilliant.
Well, I did. Once I decided that she would be a professional organizer. So she's not a decluttering guru. She's not Marie Kondo. She's read Marie Kondo, and she's inspired by a lot of, and as anyone is, oh, my goodness, she's such a good writer, and she really makes you want to fold your socks right away.
Mm-hmm.
But I decided my main character would be a professional organizer. Now, there has been professional organizers for decades, since Marie Kondo was barely born. The National Association of Professional Organizers was formed decades ago, and they are professionals who help people on a whole range of things, get all their papers organized, deal with moving out of a house that you've lived in for 40 years, the death in a family, and finally dealing with your loved one's things which are so hard to get rid of. So they just are wonderful helpmates to people who are stymied and overwhelmed just looking at all the stuff in their house. Pardon me, or their office. Or wherever. Garage, trunk of their car, you know how it is. So yeah. I did go to a meeting of NAPO, the National Association of Professional Organizers, and I met a number of women. Melanie Cirio and Kathy Bynes particularly helped me as I was writing. I kept running things by them and saying, is this logical? If I set my character up as I did, she takes pictures of things that people are about to throw away or give away or get rid of that they've had trouble parting with, thinking that the digital image of them will at least help them give the real thing away. And I wanted to make sure that was logical and reasonable for the dynamics of a professional organizer working with a client. And I was reassured, absolutely. That is something that they do, and so I incorporated it.
Well, my aunt was a hoarder. And when we went to clean out her house, it took us 3 weeks to do it, literally. I think she saved every Dear Abby and every Ann Landers. Seriously, I couldn't believe this. I was like, and my cousin said to me, you have to help me do this. And it was a good thing that I did, because she had so many papers that my cousin didn't realize that she was going to throw out the insurance money papers, too, that she wouldn't have gotten if I didn't go through every single piece of paper. But when she
probably every pocket and turn upside down all the pocketbooks and
I mean, my mother saved every phone bill from the year of the flood, I think, and every driver's license she ever got since 19 whatever. And it took me forever to do it, because I had lost my sister right before, and I'm saying I'm stuck doing all this all by myself. And my husband just got rid of furniture. He didn't even ask me. Just like, this is what we're gonna do. So Emily is really great, but there's a rule that she has when she does this. So she has Frank, and he makes her work difficult, because the rule for decluttering is she can only declutter the person's stuff, not his stuff, right? So he was allowed to do whatever he wanted. That's scary.
Yeah. Well, they have an understanding in their marriage, which is the same one that I do, which is, as long as I can't see it and as long as I'm not tripping over it, just fine. Let's keep it out of my way. And I do try to move very quickly as I go down the basement stairs across the basement to the laundry room, and try not to notice the stuff that's, I would say, growing, breeding down there. And he, in turn, tries to keep the stuff out of the main house, out of my kitchen, out of my bedroom, out of my bathroom. And I think, up to the time that the book opens, they've had a detente, I would say, about his stuff. And her training as a professional organizer has only reinforced her belief that people should only be allowed to declutter their own crap. And so I applied that to the book. And it's a problem for a lot of people. There's a hoarding, by the way, I think is a whole other thing. It's pathological. It's verging on mental illness, if not squarely in there. And so a lot of the organizers I know, for instance, try not to tackle hoarder issues because it's too complicated. Mm-hmm. It really needs a professional, mental health professional rather than, it's not really about the stuff. But the truth is, most of the issues that people have with their spouses about clutter, isn't about the stuff. It's a power dynamic.
Yeah. It's scary. My aunt had a room. I mean, she saved everything. But, I used to crack up from her. She had a room filled with enough napkins, toilet paper, paper towels, notebooks to help me, because I taught for a lot of years. So I said to her, do you have any black and white that I could use? Do you have any other? And she had enough potato chips. But she went out and bought you know, rolls of toilet paper. She used one. She went out and bought a case more. Like, you don't need another case. This was great because the two, my cousin and I, said we don't have to ever buy anything for the next 20 years after we clean out her apartment. So she gets Mrs. Murphy as a client. And what kind of help does she need, Mrs. Murphy?
Well, yes, Mrs. Murphy, when she arrives at Mrs. Murphy's house, it looks very orderly. Mrs. Murphy has been an accountant, and her husband, who is a dentist. And the house just has a very orderly feel about it, except one place where they notice that the reclining chair is in a reclining position, and there's a cup on the floor that has a tiny bit of coffee left and a newspaper that turns out was dated a year earlier. And there's an office that's just basically a time capsule. Mrs. Murphy's husband died a year earlier, and she hasn't been able to deal with anything that he left behind. And so she calls in Emily and her partner Becca to help. And you know, this is not an unusual, I mean, it's extreme, you know, the coffee cup and the newspaper. But for a lot of people, when someone dies, parting with their belongings is a very wrenching, difficult process. So that's what she has called them in about. And then there's the surprise, which is that as she's gone through her husband, or started to go through her husband's things, she's found a key. And it turns out the key is to a storage unit in a facility. And it's a storage unit that Mrs. Murphy never knew her husband had. So she also wants Emily and Becca to go investigate and figure out what the heck is in there. What was he up to?
Well, that's odd, because when you find out what's in there, you don't really, that's scary. And I'm saying, how do, you know, well, first they had to get permission, right, to go in there, and they had the key. But that's scary. So what happens when they finally go in there and Mrs. Murphy, you know, how do you deal with all that stuff when you don't know it's there?
Well, I think Mrs. Murphy at first, what she says is she can't deal with it, and they just should get rid of it all. But that, I'm not going to give away what.
No,
what's
don't.
Found
you're not
going to
give
but,
away. No.
Yeah.
She found it.
But there's no severed head. This is not Silence of the Lambs, and so anyone who reads my books can feel pretty comfortable with the likelihood that there won't be, you know, horror or gore or anything like that in my book. So when they go in, they are surprised by what they find, and it leads them to have to call in Emily's mother, who's a librarian. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I like her.
And
I like her.
Yeah, I like her too. Isn't she great?
Yeah,
she
I love
started
her. I
like out
her
as
her
a
too.
Character. Yeah, she's fun, Lila.
Yeah, I like Lila.
Anyway, so Lila is one of those very orderly, organized people. That's what librarians do. They organize things and catalog them and put them in piles. And so she's a big help trying to help them sort out what is in this storage unit and how are they going to deal with it. How are they going to break the news to Mrs. Murphy, and then they need to enlist her help to dispose of it. And it's a big job. It's a big job. And the storage unit, when they open it, is not in the condition that the facility advertises. The air conditioning has gone out, and it's a hot summer day. So it's a messy job.
I wonder about, I had a storage unit before I moved here. And I had a whole bunch of stuff. And I always wondered, do they ever really know what you put in there? And that always wonders, like it's a mystery. As I, you know, put the stuff in there and I took it out, when I finally took it out, and I'm saying, I wonder what's in the one next to mine? What's in the one above it? I mean, spices. I thought about this thing, like, I'm emptying it out. Are there weapons in the one? Does somebody have drugs in there? Do they ever really? They don't ask you what you're putting in there. You just put anything you want. And that's the scary part about it, storage locker.
You wonder, is there a camera in there? Are they watching me? That's what I would be thinking.
I guess
that
also.
I love that. Yeah, I love that in the storage facility in the book. There are CCTV cameras, which there are everywhere, but they're not in the units.
They're not in the unit, yeah.
They're outside the units, and they do monitor people's comings and goings, which you would want if you were renting a unit. You wouldn't want people hanging around there. But I love your idea of imagining all the storage units alongside you and above you. You could almost write a book of short stories, each one based on a different storage unit.
Well, yeah, my latest book just came out too, and it came out on June 9th. And my book is based on. That's why I thought about this. Those characters are dead, and they tell their story from behind the gravestone, and some of them are telling this story because somebody put them there and they were wronged. And some of them, I put them there because they deserve to be there because they did the wrong thing. And some of them are based on real-life incidents that really happened. And I killed off a lot of people, but the first two are my grandmothers. And one is based on something that happened to me when I went to school. So I'm one of the characters, but the person I killed off was my sixth grade teacher. She had it coming. What can I tell you?
What's the name of the book?
It's called Silent Voices by Fran Lewis, and I'm on a blog tour with Partners in Crime. I love them. And it's doing okay. I got 6 5-star reviews. I got 2 4-stars. And I got 1 3-star on my birthday last week that said the book was okay, and I didn't even answer the person. I don't even know where she got it from. But
yeah,
I don't care.
Yeah. I have to tell you, I try to stay out of those review things.
You don't do them?
Because
I
love it when people review my book, and I hope they all will. But as a writer, we're so sensitive, and it's like, you know, you read even a 4 or 3-star review, and the person says, you know, something that isn't all that flattering, and it's the only thing you remember as the writer. It's the only thing you remember. You don't remember all the nice things they said, and it can just get you, just get you down. And so, what's the point of that? You can't fix the book. The book is done. You know, you're on to the next thing.
I know. No, she just said, I wish you would have made the characters more psychopathic and nuts. So I didn't answer her. But I did say it on Facebook. I said, if I did that, then I would lose the credibility of the people that dictated the story the way it happened. My grandmother told me this when I was 16, what she went through in a Polish sterilization camp. My other grandmother was sold into slavery by her mother and father to somebody else. I said, and if I changed what happened in the sixth grade, then it wouldn't have been me. So I didn't care. So then she gets another client, Quinn. This is where things get interesting, people. And
yes.
Tell us about Quinn without giving, and tell us about Lolly. Poor Lolly. Oh, poor thing.
Yeah, good old Lolly. Oh, Quinn is, well.
I liked her at first, but, you know.
Yeah, well, so did Emily.
I know.
One of the things I like to write in my books are houses. And so Emily goes from Mrs. Murphy's house, mm-hmm. which is kind of a, 1950s ranch house, I guess. Very, you know, common, normal, low-key house. And then she goes to Quinn's house, and Quinn, who has called with this, I need help right away. In fact, she's called Emily's husband's law partner when Becca says, no, we don't work on Saturdays, and she's coerced Emily into coming over. And when Emily arrives, the house is a real McMansion. It's enormous. And, you know, limestone blocks and pillars in the front. And it's just a gigantic house. And Emily is one of these people like me who's kind of cowed by money. You know, it rocks her back on her heels. She's immediately on the defensive, even though she thinks that's stupid. But when the door opens, it's not anyone wearing a ball gown or you know, fancy clothes. The woman who opens the door, is just dressed in, you know, yoga pants and a yoga top and probably Lululemon. But she welcomes Emily in, and her problem is the reverse of most people's problems. She's been married to her husband for a couple of years. It's his house. He owned it before they got married. It's full of his curated collections of old advertising signs and magazine covers, very specialized niche of collecting, and he's a connoisseur. And all the stuff that she owns before she got married is sitting in their garage. He promised her that she could move it into the house before they got married, but he won't let her. So he's just barricaded the house against her presence. And so she comes off as very sympathetic, you know. Now she's just given up, and she wants Emily's help to just get rid of it all, so she can not be reminded every time she goes and gets into her car of how controlling her husband is. At least she can take this one bit of control herself. And so they bond in an evening where Quinn complains about her husband, and as they drink a little wine and a little more wine, Emily starts complaining about hers. And so in the process of it, they both imagine life without their spouses. Like, would it be better to be single again? And how could that happen? So that's really the kickoff for the mystery.
Especially the title. You know how many people often say,
I wish I had this,
or I wish I could do that, and careful what you wish for, because it could possibly come true. You just never know.
Right.
I mean, exactly. I think about that every day. Like, what would have happened if this didn't happen? And sometimes I say, like, I wish it didn't happen because I didn't deserve this to happen. And you say, you know, I wish I could change something about what I did. Oh, I wish somebody would. You can't. That's why the title is so perfect, because people do that.
Yeah.
Oh, I wish I had $1 million. Well, you know, maybe if I do that, I'll get it. So Emily gets in trouble. How come the police all of a sudden are interested in Emily? And then Frank, her husband, and, you know, warns them, when you talk to police, well, anybody that talks to the police and tells them everything is ridiculous, you know, they're not there to help you. They're there to get you. So you got to be careful. So what happens when they do call to her? Why do they want to talk to her at all?
Well, first of all, you know, I'm trying to remember exactly when the police get active on the scene, and in particular when they set their sights on Emily. Part of it is something that she finds in the storage unit. When she goes back to the storage unit, the key has been changed and the lock has been changed, and when she gets into it, she finds something that she wasn't expecting. I don't want to give that away.
No, no.
But at the same time, Quinn's husband, Wally, the one she's been complaining about, disappears. And there's a bunch of circumstances that lead the police to think that Emily has some kind of connection with all of these things. And so they show up, and her husband's an attorney, and he spent a couple of years as a defense attorney before he went into corporate law. And he knows that the police are not your friends. When they're trying to find information, they can lie to you, but you can't lie to them. That's the uneven playing field, and that's the reality. And even though she knows nothing about, she's never met Wally, she doesn't know what happened to him. She has no idea at all when they ask her questions. He still warns her against even answering innocuous questions. You just never know how it can be used against you. And, you know, she thinks he is speaking from experience here. And it's an interesting question when police question you. You know, you want to help. You want to be helpful. She certainly does. she's what you know I would call a good girl, but it's not necessarily in your own best interest because your words can be twisted and used against you, and that's what she finds happens.
I know. You know, after reviewing so many books and dealing with so many different things, I actually interviewed someone that was dealing with someone that was actually in prison. And I learned a lot from that. And I know that according to any book that you read, the police are not your friends, even though they say, oh, we want to help you. And they also tell you never to take a plea bargain. Because
Oh, that's interesting, really?
This was an interesting book because the man was in jail for 60 years for having possession of drugs. He didn't deserve to be it. He didn't deserve it. And I don't know if he ever. It's a true story, yeah. And he wanted to come on the show.
Three strikes and you're out, kind of. You know, in those days, three minor offenses could get you that kind of prison term.
Yeah. And from what I understand, he didn't deserve it. But there's nothing that, you know, he can do about it. And this lady is an advocate for people in prison. As a matter of fact, there is a lawyer that I interviewed, David R. Dow, Confessions of an Innocent Man. He deals with the death penalty, but he also helps people that are on death row or in prison to get out. But he does believe that if they deserve it, oh well. So let's talk more a little bit about Quinn. She was an interesting character, seriously. She had sort of like a mixed personality. I begin to think that she was a little off at times. So what about her? Does she seem at times upset? And at other times she seems cold. And other times you wonder, what is she really thinking? She was an odd character.
Good. I'm glad that she struck you that way because it's almost as if she's on another wavelength from Emily. Yeah, she's as much outside herself, watching herself, as she is within herself, being herself. And it takes Emily a while to realize that, and wonder, you know, what exactly is going on with her. You know, I just think she is an enigma, and she is cold, but she also knows how to lure people. She's quite the seductress, both of men and women, in terms of wanting people to like her, to bend them to her will. And, you know, I've certainly met people like that who are, you know, one minute just, you know, rapt, interested, listening to everything, thinking, oh, I'm the best person ever, and this person is so interested in me, and then come to find out they're really basically wrapped up in themselves. So the relationship between Emily and Quinn evolves, shall we say, and eventually, you know, we find out what exactly is Quinn's backstory, and that's the thing in the kinds of books I write is it's always about backstory. It's always the secret in a character's past that's going to reveal why they're behaving the way they are, which, as you say, seems odd in the present.
Yeah.
But once you know that, it kind of explains it all. So she has a past.
Well, I'll tell you, that's what made me read the book in like a day. I just picked it up and read it. And the scary part is that I had a pile that was, you know, that they said, could you please read these right away? They go, wait a minute. You know, that's what happens when you get a book that you don't know you're getting. And then you sit down and I look to see, you know, what's the book about? And the title got me and I'm saying, oh, wait a minute, the other book's going to have to wait. And of course, people weren't happy, but I didn't care because I figured I'm doing this for free so I can do it however I want. And
it makes me very happy to hear that because I had a lot of fun writing it. You know, I like to write, well, the opening line of the book is something like, I don't have it right here, but Emily Harlow wasn't sure if her sock drawer sparked joy. And I love that opening line, but it's really an unusual opening line for a murder mystery, you know, for a mystery novel, for a suspense novel, which are more what mine are. And I always felt like I was taking a risk starting the book slow, because it starts with her folding socks. And
yeah, I see. I have it in front of me.
Gradually builds up ahead of steam. Yeah, so that by, you know, page 250, it's barreling along. And that's exactly what I had hoped would happen, is that the opening would lure you in and then you wouldn't be able to put it down as it moves along.
Well, it's good, because there are some that I have inside that I'd like to send to somebody else to read them, seriously. I've got a whole bunch inside that are really scary. I mean, scary to the point of, oh my God, I can't wait to finish this book to find out what happens, but it's scaring me. And I actually have to post these things right away. And there's one, it's called If I Had Two Lives, and it's the character has no name. And she lives in a camp, and her mother hates her, or she tries to pretend to like her. And this poor child has been abused by everyone, and it's scary. And then she's going to move to someplace else, and I'm going, I can't wait for the book to be over. But what can I tell you? Before I forget, next Thursday I'm interviewing Dr. Robert Testito. What the F is wrong with our healthcare system and people? It's F is for food. And he deals with a sensibility diet and how you deal with high cholesterol, diabetes, and high blood pressure with diet. I can't wait to read that one, do that one. On the 10th, TrinityHouseEntertainment.inc, the people that did my opening, Rachel and Michael will be here with their new inspirational song, United We Stand. On the 15th, this is so exciting, John Land is going to be here with for Capital White with Joe Pistone, and we're going to talk about Donnie Brasco. That's all I'm going to give away. On the 16th, the author of What She Never Said. On the 21st, I don't know if you know Shannon Kirk, Gretchen.
I do.
On the 20th, you do? I love
Shannon
her.
Kirk.
She sent me the book herself. I'm like, this is a scary book. You want to know scary? Gretchen's scary. And Elizabeth Crowens is another famous person that's been at Thriller Fest. I'm doing two books in one. I've never done this before. Silent Meridian and Pocket Full of Lodestones, and I hope I can do this right. On the 29th, somebody that I adore and love, he's one of my favorite people in the world, Vincent Zandri, Primary Termination, and you can tell Frank that if he doesn't follow the rules, that's what happens. Primarily terminated, seriously. And on the 31st, yes, it just scared me. I go like, oh, my God, you don't follow the rules and you're gone. And, yeah, and the 31st on Halloween, The Road to Nowhere by Cy Weiss. And it deals with the main character is a sleuth, but she turns into a feline cat at night, and that's how she solves murders. That's all I'm going to say about that one. And so tell us more about Lila and how she helps Emily. And what does she realize, you know, after a while? Lila is really smart. Without giving it away, what does she realize after a while, Lila, that sends off like a red flag here or there?
Well, let me just back up a second and say, friend,
okay,
you are amazing. All those books that you're reading in such a short period of time. I used to review for the Boston Globe, and it sounds like you are reading like 3-4 times as many as I could possibly chew and digest. So, yeah, my hat off to you. Good for you. And it's such a gift to writers. So let me thank you on behalf of the writers out there.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And now, okay, so Lila. Well, Lila, gosh, Lila is the no-nonsense, brassy character who has no illusions about what she's seeing. She knows her daughter's limitations. She knows exactly what's going on in her daughter's marriage, or she thinks she does. And she, when they open up the storage unit and Emily realizes she really needs the expertise of a librarian, and better yet, if a librarian who's related to her, so she can play her cards close to her chest. When she realizes she needs that expertise, she, of course, calls her mother. And her mother, when she sees what's in the storage unit, at first she takes it at face value, let me just say. And but eventually it's really her expertise and her sleuthing that get them to realize what exactly is in there and what the implications are for Mrs. Murphy. And then she also bonds with Mrs. Murphy. She and Mrs. Murphy are basically the same age, even though they're totally opposite. But that's another dynamic in the book, which is that she gets Mrs. Murphy to trust her, perhaps more than is in her own good interest to trust anyone at that point. So so I one of the things I like to do is defy stereotypes, and one of the stereotypes I'm working against in this book is the idea of the helpless wife. Alila is anything but a helpless wife, and many of the other characters start looking that way, but then they turn out to be anything but. And that's what Lila's good at. She's good at sussing out artifice, whether it's in a manuscript or in a person.
She's like my mother. Seriously. She's scary.
Really?
I mean, my mother couldn't tell you. She knew everything. I didn't have to say anything. I mean, I would come home from school. If I didn't get 100 on a test, I had to write it over, the whole test. And I would walk in and I would say to her, "Hi, Ma." And she would say to me, "What did you get?" I go, "Which teacher called you and ratted me out?" And if I got 100, that was fine. If I got 99, she would say, "You need to write it over." I go, "How about just the example?" "Nope, the whole thing, seriously." And she just knew. She was just like, I mean, the reason why I can read 10 books in 2 weeks, seriously, is because she made me read 6 every week besides Hebrew lessons, piano lessons, violin lessons, and I hated dancing lessons. That's a whole other horror. And she would say to me, you have to read 6 books a week, and I had to take notes on them. And I had to write cards on them. And you should see what I did to your book. And there's a girl in Rite Aid that asked me for this yesterday, so I've got it on my table. She wants it. I promised her that she would get it because she loves me. seriously, she made me take notes, and now I do that when I read a book. So by the time I finish taking notes and underlining, I have the book memorized, and the review is on my phone.
That's
and
amazing.
If I don't put the I learned that you have a notepad on your phone, and my computer doesn't love me. And the other day I typed something. My niece is went to nursing school, so I was helping her type her term papers and helping her write them, and it disappeared. And then I typed something else. Yeah, I typed something else the other day, and I was having a fit because it disappeared. And I said, "Ha, gotcha, it's on my phone." So I reprinted it. I was like, I had a fit. This is like, that's why. You got to remember these things. So by the time I finished reading your book, I had it memorized. I was able to write the review. I don't know if Gina sent it to you, but it's on my site, and people have been reading it. It's the weirdest thing, because lately I've been getting people that are reading reviews that I wrote 10 years ago when I first started, and Amazon is saying, "Oh, you're really helping people." Like, I don't even remember reading that one. Anyway, well, the police get a search warrant. So what do they want? What are they looking for? Because not everybody is who they seem. That's all I'm going to say about that.
Yeah. Well, what they're initially looking for is Emily claims that the lock was changed on the storage unit.
Yeah.
And as I said, when she opened the storage unit, she found something she wasn't expecting. And so the police are investigating how that happened because something bad happened. And so they go to her house to see if she actually has that old lock. Did she save it? Yeah, they look, you know, they want to look in her car, they want to look in her house, because they don't believe that she just returned and and somebody came in at night and switched the lock. And so they even tell her that they have her on CCTV camera changing the lock. And she knows she wasn't there. And so they still don't believe her, because, sure enough, there is some nice blurry footage that looks exactly like her doing exactly that. So as the story gets more complicated, the police will come back again with another search warrant, now looking for evidence that she might be, or her husband might be, involved somehow in a crime. And it turns out she actually knows a lot more than she thinks she knows. And at some point she starts to wonder, as her husband keeps telling her, do not talk to the police. Do not tell them, you know, you don't have to say a thing. She starts to wonder if that's really the best advice or not. And, you know, any of us would in that situation. The police can really do a number on you.
Tell me about
it. But it turns out in this book, actually, the police are not the bad guys.
Well, you have to be careful in general who you talk to. Seriously. I mean, even
yep.
the people at the storage locker, you got to be careful. You know, you don't want them to catch on, whatever. So there's another character in the book, Rafe. Tell us about him, and how did she decide that Becca was the one that she wanted to be partners with?
Rafe Bartok? Is that who you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. I now have to remember. Who is Rafe? I don't want to talk about Rafe. Rafe is
we'll leave him out.
Let's just say that when people get to seeing his name in the book, they should start to pay attention, because he's a very pivotal character, even though he's not actually part of the book. But I can talk about Becca and Emily. I mean, Becca and Emily are like me and my friend Jody from high school, you know. We hung out together in junior high. We were not very popular, not popular at all, in fact, and just a pair of unaffiliated nerds. Who just tried to keep our heads down, and Emily was Becca's bridesmaid at her wedding, and Becca was a nurse, and now she's just a very practical. She has an amazing ability to interact with people. She has a good business sense. So when it all begins when Emily reads. Basically Marie Kondo's book about organizing your life, and she organizes her sock drawer and makes a video of it. She does this kind of herky-jerky animation video showing her sock drawer going from chaos to orderly, and she posts it on Instagram. And I loved being able to write about Instagram and cell phones and all the great things that now can complicate our crime novels. Anyway, she posts on Instagram, and she gets this huge following. There's articles about her in the local paper. And so she decides not to go back to teaching what she's been doing, but to team up with Becca and start a business as professional organizers. And so Becca's just the perfect person for her to do this with. The complication is Becca is happily married. She has two great kids. And Emily she thinks she's happily married, but sometimes she wonders, and she and her husband have been having trouble conceiving a child. And that can really throw a monkey wrench into a relationship between friends, women in their 30s, one of whom, you know, has just pumped out those babies, and the other one who desperately wants one but has not managed to conceive. And so I wanted to put that dynamic into the book. It also affects Emily's relationship with her husband, of course, that disappointment that they both feel, and hoping against hope that that she will, that they'll have a child. So Becca serves a lot of purposes. She's also just a wonderful sounding board for Emily. She's common sense. She's down to earth. She's a rock. And so she provides that kind of ballast for Emily as the book goes. She and Lila, Emily's mother, are the two people that Emily can really, really, really trust and not think twice about.
Well, I was worried because I didn't want them to be in danger, Becca and
Lila.
Yeah,
good. Yeah, well, one of of the things that, you know, I don't like books that are graphically gory or too scary. I turn off shows that get too suspenseful. So my writing, I really try to walk the line of telling a story without getting icky and without getting scary, but still suspenseful and make you want to know what happens. So I'm always aware of that, because that's the kind of books I like. I like to write the kind of books I like to read.
That's good, because I often wonder sometimes, after an author writes the book, I often wonder, what would the author write if they had to review their own book? What would they say? What would they critique, or what would they not? I did that with Silent Voices, and I'm saying, okay, what would I give my book? And I don't know. I'm partial, because I think it's great. But then there are people that think it's too scary, or they think it's too sad. And a lot of people said the writing is great, but it's not really for them, because they don't like the dead body behind the gravestone. It's my fifth one that I wrote. The truth of the matter is, my sister died, and I went to the cemetery. I looked at her gravestone, and I said, if you could tell me what happened to you that day that you had a heart attack, what would you tell me? What would be the truth about what I don't know? And there's a lot of hidden truths about that. So, and I walked around the rest of the cemetery, and I go, Mrs. So-and-so, did you do something wrong? And I wondered why all these people were there. And then I took pictures of some of the headstones at a different, my mother-in-law's cemetery, and go, if you could speak to me, what would you say? And I said, wouldn't that be cool to write a book like that for some reason?
I think that's such a brilliant idea. But
it
I
was
will
just
say,
different.
I think we are our own toughest critics, too. I mean, I find when I write something, you know, I'll look at what I wrote for the day or even while I'm writing and think, this is awful. This is just crap. I mean, and I keep going and I keep going, because I know that the next day when I read it, it won't smell quite as bad as I thought it did, and I'll be able to fix what I don't like. But even after that, I'm not sure that we recognize what our best work is or the work that needs change. I really think we need readers. I mean, did you find that with your book, that you had people that you trusted to read it and help you?
Without a doubt. But I have an editor, and Maxine knows the rule. Don't tell me if I have grammar mistakes, because I don't want to hear it. I'm a reading and writing specialist. I taught kids with learning disabilities, and I did writing staff development. And I just said, you fix the grammar. Don't tell me what I did. I don't care. Just fix it. And she knows not to tell me that I spelled a word wrong or that I, you know, have the sentences too long, because I don't want to hear it. I don't want to know. But what she does do is tell me if she has questions about, you know, something that doesn't make sense or content and stuff like that. That'll fix. The rest, I don't want to know. It's like we all write, and I just type. I never read what I write until afterwards. And then I'll say to myself, okay, Maxine, and then I'll read it. And what happens is I'll send it to FedEx to print it out, because I can't read on my computer. And then I have like 20 copies of the book, and I'll read it over, and then I'll read it over again, and I'll go like, you wrote that? Oh, my God, what's wrong with you? And then I'll write it again. And then this time, for the first time, I asked Vincent Zandri, Larry Thompson, James Heyman, and a few other authors to read it before I sent it to be published. That was brave.
Well, that's good.
Let me tell you. That was
and
really
did you
brave.
Get
and I did.
Back?
Yeah, one of them told me to flesh out the characters a little bit more and make them more in depth, which I did. Vincent said it was good. John Land read it. R.G. Belsky is a reporter that you might know, and he gave me a review. He gave me a blurb for the book. So obviously they liked it. Larry Thompson said it was great, but he couldn't review it because he said it was too sad, which is fine.
Yeah.
But he's a great – you know what? Not everybody likes, you know, what you read. I don't care. It's just that they didn't say it was bad.
Right. I mean, you know, as a reader, you don't like everything other people like. I
mean,
that's what it is about reading. Yeah, that's what it is about literature, is that there's something for everyone out there, and there's also something not for everyone, you know, that you're not going to like, and you just have to do your own thing.
Well, the truth of the matter is that everybody knows that I won't write a negative review. If I get a book, seriously, that is so bad, and I've gotten a few recently that are really so bad, I'll just tell the publicist, I'll give you a summary, I will not put it on Amazon, and I will not rate the book, and I will not write a derogatory review, because somebody else may like it. And if somebody published a book and worked really hard
and thinks that what they wrote is fantastic, I'm not going to tell you that you're writing that the plot line made no sense, or that the characters don't fit into the story, or that your ending or that your murder scene was corrupted and it doesn't make sense at all. It's not my place to say that. I'll just say that in this particular case, I'll just give you a summary of the book on my site, on Just Reviews, but I won't put it on Amazon. Because there was an author last week that said, how come you didn't put it on Amazon? I said, the book was really humorous and funny, but the language was a little over the top, and I didn't write it in my review. I said, so I gave you 4 stars because I felt that it could have been better written without all the language. It just sort of ruined it. But I didn't write that in my review because I don't want to. You know, other people thought it was fantastic.
Yeah, so no, I understand completely. Yeah.
Yeah, I won't do that. So, we have Quinn. She's so mean, but she's such a good mean character. So how did you create the final scenes without giving it away? I was like, Oh my God, how are they going to do this? And how is she going to end this without scaring me too much? Because, you know, you do feel suspense and you get tense because you wonder what's going to happen at the end of the book.
Right.
So how did you create that tension at the end without making me close my eyes and getting scared? Seriously.
I feel like the end of the book, when things come together, is a complete miracle. I did not know how I was going to. It was a complete miracle that I did not really know how everything was going to shake out. I knew there would be a scene in the. I knew I wanted to end the book or make the climactic scene in the storage room. And that much I knew, and I sort of knew who would be there, but the whole what I love about that scene is that the reader thinks this shoe is going to drop, and it turns out a different shoe drops.
Uh huh.
Yeah, and that honestly came to me as I was writing.
That was brilliant. The ending was great.
I had to go back and make it work because the ending that I had written didn't make as much sense as it needed to, given how I had set up the beginning of the book. So I actually had to go back and change a few things. Not too long ago, I was at a writing conference, and I heard the great writer, Walter Mosley, say this. He said, story is what happened. Plot is the order in which it's revealed to the reader. And I would say plot is also the order in which it's revealed to the writer, because I gradually realized what had happened in this fictional world when I brought it all together at the end, which sounds weird, I know, but there is this feeling of what really happened, what really, really happened. And all through the book, you know, you're writing from the perspective of the characters who don't really know. They just have their own experiences, but lurking behind the scenes are the real facts. And that's, so writing the book for me was a way of discovering it. And that scene in particular, I was like, oh my God. And then that was really over the top. Make it work.
So before we end, are you bringing Emma and Becca back? Because according to the last part of the book, it seems like they're going to do more. You're going to write another one, a sequel,
yeah.
I hope?
I haven't decided. I haven't decided if I have another story for them. I think if I did another book, Lila would be more of a player.
Mm-hmm.
I've just been, you know, these last few months I've been dealing with the book launch, and I have a bunch of freelance assignments that keep a little money flowing in, and I haven't really decided what's next for me and whether Emily and Becca, whether there'll be a book two. But I will say this is the first, I've written 6 suspense novels, and this is the first one where when I got to the end I thought, you know, I could write a sequel. I could write another book with these characters. Yeah. And then maybe several more. So, but I also, I don't know. I'm not Well, I wrote a series early on in my career. I wrote a series featuring a forensic neuropsychologist, a doctor, and I wrote five books with a co-author for St. Martin's. And I liked writing a series, but it doesn't pack the same punch for me as a writer. It doesn't have the same satisfaction as writing my standalones. And so I'm wary of giving up standalone and starting a series, because once you write a second one, then, you know, maybe I'll write a third one, and then you're in that kind of the publisher wants a book a year kind of churning. And I kind of feel like I've been there, done that, and I would like to come up with a fresh idea. I do have a fresh idea. I just have to write it. Easy peasy.
No, I get it, because I read books in series. And one of the panel shows that I did was based on what happens when you write a book in a series, how do you keep that main character from boring the reader like me? And
right.
It was interesting. Well, the people that do write it, John Land, Caitlin Strong is phenomenal, Alan Topol and Craig Page, they change it every time. And, of course, John Land, if anybody doesn't know, he's doing the new Murder, She Wrote series. He brought Jessica Fletcher into a whole new world, and he wrote the next one is coming out on December 5th. He'll be on to talk about A Date with Murder, and it's phenomenal. No, I mean, Time for Murder, and he brings in her husband Frank. So before we end, where can everybody learn more about you? And I hope when you write the next one, I get it seriously.
Oh, you definitely will, Fran. Not to worry. My website is always the best place to find me, just hallieephron.com, HallieEphron.com, and I've my appearances are there. I have a full schedule right up until Christmas, and then even some stuff in the next year. And if you want to get in touch with me, either I'm happy to do book groups or Skype a book group, or if you're nearby. Whatever. Anyway, it's easy to get in touch with me. I answer my emails personally. And there's a newsletter link, too. So I don't do a lot of newsletters. I'm one of these, you know, maybe every 4 months I'll write one. So you don't have to worry about being inundated. But they're always fun. And I write a little about writing, and I write a little about my books, and I let you know where I'll be. So it's a low overhead newsletter. But HallieEphron.com is the best place.
Actually, I found it before because I emailed
you
to tell you to comment, to call in. I did. I found it. Actually found it.
Did.
And I'm going to send you and Gina the link to the show after.
Thank you. And I'll put it on my website.
Oh, good. This has been fun. And I will send you the link to my review. People are reading it. Seriously, it's amazing. I don't know why, but I post something, and about 2 seconds later, 10 people have already read it. I go like, how did you read that so fast? How did you know I wrote it? And now
of
a sudden, WordPress is telling me that I did a good job promoting my whatever I'm doing. And I'm like, you even noticed that I exist? And, yeah, it's really interesting. But I want to thank you so much. This has been fun. And if Emily ever decides to come to Real, I really would love to have her fix my closet. Thank you so much. Everybody,
too,
it's a beautiful day outside. Have a great day, and thank you, Hallie, and bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.